We Have Issues is a weekly podcast full of reviews of comics and oversharing. We use grown-up language to make very childish jokes. You can find the show at wehaveissues.net, as well as anywhere else where average to not too bad podcasts can be found.
He looks like Salacious Crumb.
I'm not going to say anything horrible about John because he's my friend.
Yeah.
Well, he's my friend too, but I mean, I have observed that he looks like Salacious Crumb.
Jessie hasn't got to the point in her life where she's just horrible to her friends all
the time. Oh, no, I am. You guys are just older and I don't want to get punched.
Why not?
Old people do not punch younger people.
I'm surrounded by cis men. I don't know.
She's right. She is.
I am cis.
It hadn't occurred to me that this might be a threatening environment.
If you're not careful, I will use my white male middle class privilege on you.
Fuck.
I think we should start doing the podcast.
Yeah, right.
I'm now obsessed with the sound levels. This is intense.
Well, that's good. You're the producer. You want to be.
Yeah.
I tell you what, we'd have made a damn sight better podcast over the last 5 years if you'd been a little bit more obsessed. May I say? May I say, Nick?
That is a fair character assassination.
Thank you.
Is this the show?
Yeah, this is the show. I've agreed.
It's my job to tell you guys that. Listener, this is We Have Issues. We are a podcast about comics. We'll start talking about comics in a minute.
Haven't you already said that at the beginning of the show?
Kind of, yeah, but they'll have forgotten that because of the kick-ass music done by David Wynn.
I really like it. I like it right at the end where it gets all exciting.
And the,
it makes me listen to the end every time. I'm like, ooh, where's this going?
It's cleverly designed.
And the logo by Mike Georgiou. It's worth mentioning the logo because this week it's been on the front page of iTunes.
It's been all over it.
Oh, are you going to do this? Oh, yeah. This is self-aggrandizing.
It's important because we do actually have, it's difficult to believe, I've been looking at the numbers and we've got at least 20 more listeners.
What, you mean we've
Since
got 30 listeners now?
No.
Brilliant.
No, it's doubled. Doubled our listening. Don't be so down on the numbers. We've got at least 20
that's
listeners.
That's amazing. People are listening to us.
We've doubled the numbers.
Shit.
They're wondering why. At this exact moment in time, they're wondering why. If you are a new listener, welcome. We will talk about comics in a minute. Thank you very much for coming and finding us. We don't know how to make the most of something like New and Noteworthy, because James and I have not been brought up on the internet, and Jesse is intimidated by our by the patriarchy, really.
Yeah,
into not really saying anything.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's not my fault. I'm oppressed.
Can you hear the fear in her voice?
I know
it's not good.
Save
now it's
me.
You see, the problem is now it sounds like I'm making light of all of this stuff, and I don't mean to.
Yeah, we were having a really serious conversation about this, like, 10 minutes ago, and now we've already gone to mocking, like, real issues.
So what you're saying to the listener, Jesse, is we were having a good time till you guys turned up.
I'm really sorry, but can you guys leave?
We have covered, in the time it took us to get a studio that actually worked, we've had a bit of trouble getting started, and we've covered the ridiculously draconian and women-hating porn laws in this country. We talked a little bit about gender politics, the deep diving gender politics that I really don't want to get started on this show because
we're positive over here.
Yes, we're positive here. Talked about other stuff. We talked about the frustrations of getting a working studio. And James and Jesse started talking about comics, which is not done. We've got to talk about comics on the show.
We had a little chat about retarded ejaculation as well.
We had a long chat about retarded ejaculation. Newcomers to the show might not have heard James talk about it. Do you want to just give them a quick recap?
Freudian slip. I take antidepressants, and one of the side effects is retarded ejaculation, whereby I can be having sexual intercourse for a very long time and not orgasm.
So line up, ladies. No, that's in poor taste.
No, because I'm still disgusting to be in bed with.
No, I think we should take this opportunity to give, like, you know, sex etiquette lessons over here.
Setiquette.
Actually, it's interesting because this week in comics, the Matt Fraction Chip Starsky
Just the Tips
sex education or sex advice book came out. And I've seen it in the shop, and it's this really nice little pink a square hardcover. It looks amazing. I'm not going to buy it. I don't need any advice.
Isn't there an Ojoy sex toy book out at the moment as well? So
I think there is. I didn't see. I don't think we've got that in our local shop.
No, I think you have to buy it from Erica Mohn's store, don't you?
Yes, I think
you can
so.
Do. It's very good if you you're not aware of Ojoy sex toy. It's a brilliant sex positive blog.
I will. Everything she does is amazing.
Very good. Yeah.
I will put links to that in the show notes. If you're a new listener to the show, there you may not know this. There are full show notes for every episode, including timings for when certain reviews start and stuff like that, on the post for this episode at the website.
Shotes.
Yeah, you shorten show notes to shotes.
Mm. I do like a compound word.
Because sometimes it's show-notes. Mm. Then sometimes people don't bother with the dash. That shortens it. But yeah, Shotes is even better.
Yeah.
You can find all those episodes at wehaveissues.net.
I'm going to be very much like Tim Berners-Lee, and I'm going to give that to the world. The world can have Shotes for free.
Shotes?
Yeah.
I was listening to a podcast earlier on today about the man who invented the pop-up advert.
Well, had to be a man, didn't it?
Well, he had very nice reasons for doing it, but he was so apologetic and I felt sorry for him.
What's a pop-up advert? Sorry, Jesse.
I'm okay. I know we're gonna do this whole like I'm so much younger than you.
Yeah,
but I'm
well, you
not,
are
like,
considerably younger.
So
than
much
us.
Like, don't treat me like a child.
She's not a child.
That's all you ever do.
That's all I ever do. To be fair,
you're always like, you won't know this, Jesse, because you're far younger and you know nothing of the world.
I'm not like that. I'm much more open-minded about the young.
It's part of my charm. It isn't. I'm really sorry, listener. This is another thing that I feel I need to address. And the person who brought this up is probably going to feel like this is me being passive aggressive, but I'm not being passive aggressive. It has been possible dipping into what I do on Twitter. I'm at Nixite, listener, or Facebook. I'm on Facebook, listener. We'll talk about where everyone is in a minute. To not quite enter in listening to this podcast and the other podcast James and I do, to not quite know where I stand on Gamergate. I don't like Gamergate. I've examined some of the stuff I've said recently, and because I tend to try and look at why people think the way they think, I have said things that have led people quite close to me to believe that I might actually be kind of okay with Gamergate, and I'm really not. I just felt like I should address that. Everything needs to be taken in context. The context normally, in my case, is everything's ridiculous.
So essentially, fuck Gamergate.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah, maybe. Let's say, if we've got to take a stance, let's take that one.
Can I address something more positive in pop culture, if that's okay, before we get going? Of course, over the last week or so, been a massive trailer that's come out. So I just wanted to ask you are you excited for Jurassic World, as I am?
Oh, you misled me.
Yeah, do you see what I did there?
Oh, you misled me.
That was misdirection.
I took you up a garden path.
How dare you?
Yeah.
I did see Guardians of the Galaxy this week, and for the first time, and I'd like to watch Chris Pratt in that again, definitely. I didn't really like the trailer for Jurassic World. Sorry, James.
I refuse to watch the trailer.
No.
You refuse?
I refuse. The only trailer I've... teaser. I've only seen the Star Wars teaser because I had to, because
it's the law.
I have, yeah, essentially. But I don't want to watch any of the trailers. They're going to ruin things for me.
And of course, when I mentioned trailer, what I meant was obviously the Star Wars trailer. It looks good, doesn't it? I like the lightsaber that looks like a broadsword. Apparently, I read the Sith. The reason it looks like that is apparently Luke Skywalker's kind of gone into hiding because he's gone all chicken shit. And there are like Force adepts across the galaxy, but he's had to forge his own lightsaber with no formal training at all. So I think he's done very well.
What's interesting about the teaser trailer for Star Wars is
the ball droid.
Is it really doesn't give that much away, which is how a trailer should be.
Mm. It gives you the look at the world, but doesn't tell you what it's about.
Yeah, which is kind of how it should be. James, though, is just like, I was just happy looking at it, dude.
I was disappointed not to see Jar Jar.
Or any CGI for the matter. Mm.
There were
CGI'd monsters,
dead-eyed monsters.
Yeah, very George Lucas.
There was you mean when you say dead-eyed monsters, you're talking about Anthony Daniels?
No, I'm talking about George Lucas. I heard you taking down Anthony Daniels last week, and I have to say, I didn't care for it.
Well, that's just your opinion, dude.
Well, no, it was a feeling. It wasn't an opinion. It was a feeling. I didn't care for it.
That's
made me feel something.
Feeling, dude. Why do you like Anthony Daniels?
I think he's a very talented actor. I think he completely changed the character of C-3PO. Originally, he was going to be very much in the manner of a New York car salesman. Mm-hmm. But the performance he gave while on set so enamoured George Lucas that he decided to keep Daniels' performance.
So you think that because the character was supposed to be like a New York cabbie.
No, I said a New York car salesman.
A New York car salesman. Mm. And Anthony Daniels did him as a pretty English dude who's a bit full of himself. Mm. That was a sign of him being a really good actor.
Yeah, and you were taking him down as well. He's quite theatrical, but that's just the world he comes from. I don't think he's as lardy-dardy as you were making on.
Maybe, I don't know. I've never met the dude.
I think you're just jealous.
Yeah.
I am just jealous. If I was going to be a character in Star Wars, I'd have wanted to be C-3PO. No, I'd want to be R2. R2-D2's amazing.
It's not like he's just any random... He's motherfucking C-3PO. Like,
he is motherfucking C-3PO. I
think part of it is I hate C-3PO as well. What does he do? Oh, he translates for everyone. Oh,
you should love yourself, Nick.
No, what?
Love yourself.
I do love my... Well, I don't. I don't love myself, but I like myself more than I like C-3PO. What does he do, aside from translating stuff?
He saved them in the... What was it? When they were in the garbage chute.
Yeah, eventually.
He was the one talking to them, and he managed to save them. I mean, it wasn't... He wasn't doing a saving. It was R2, but technically. But he was the one intercepting the messages and everything.
And he can program binary load lifters, which are very similar to moisture evaporators.
We are fighting this case for C-3PO.
Well, anyway, I haven't liked anything Star Wars in a remarkably long time, and I loved that trailer.
Well, you've not watched The Clone Wars, because I'm watching it at the moment, and I have to say it's very good. I like Anakin Skywalker's, what's her name? Ahsoka. She's good. I like her character.
Ahsoka?
Ahsoka Tano.
Oh, Ahsoka.
Yeah.
Ahsoka sounds like one of those jobs on a porn set.
See,
like
I thought it was pronounced Ahsoka, as in, like, from Buddhism. But it wasn't Ahsoka.
How do they say it?
Her name was Lola. She was Ahsoka.
Was Ahsoka?
Ahsoka, yeah.
I don't know. But she's good. I like her. Yeah. Good character.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she's not a porn set person.
No, she's not a porn set person. I thought that joke kind of fell flat the first time around. But
I'm
telling you what, repeating it.
Makes all
still
the
not funny.
I think it's quite funny. Jesse, because you're quite young...
Jesus.
We're going to lead with that every time.
It was going to be a joke about how the porn regulations are making it so that in the UK we won't have...
Yeah, it's going to ruin my future, like, job plans, really.
Oh, Lorks and Lordy.
Oh, you're going to produce or something? They've got great scripts.
That's right. I was going to be screenplay writer.
Actually, I have to say the craft has gone, because in the 70s, which is my preferred... 70s and early 80s is my preferred period.
What, with the bush and everything?
I haven't got a problem with women having hair where they're meant to have hair, Jesse. It's fine.
where they're meant to have hair.
I mean, I choose to trim because of a thing called the visible inch. I prefer, because there was
the
a story.
Visible inch is such a great term. Yeah. You don't need, it doesn't need any explaining.
No.
I've never heard it before, but it's perfect.
It's perfect. But there was a story, and quite often you'll find that sometimes the actual sex scenes are sacrificed in length for the story, which is very much the other way around now. Oh, I've met you on the street. Let's have sex. And then there's just sex.
See, I always skip to the end. I want to see if they get married.
Oh, I thought you meant just like the cum shot.
Sorry.
I'm sure I've got a parody of Snow White somewhere where that happens.
Snow White. Brilliant.
Somnophilia, isn't it? That would be. That's a good porn idea. Why am I not writing this down?
She doesn't have sex while she's asleep. I assume that's what that is.
Well, she's asleep. He's the one having sex.
I am not going to make any cracks about Julian Assange at this point.
Just to clarify for one of our listeners, and a friend of the show, not a show, well, and a show, who I'm hoping will contribute at some point to this one in the near future. Max, be careful with the white water. Sometimes it's milk, sometimes it's not milk. He needs that clarifying today, because it's been a while since he's seen any milk.
Oh, that's not good. I hope more milk is forthcoming very shortly.
I miss Max.
I like him. He's got a lovely voice.
He has. Jesse, he's got a lovely voice.
I've never met Max, and I want to. I fear I'm going to be a bit overexcited when I eventually do and be a bit overwhelming at him.
He's taller than you expect.
Is he taller than me?
No, he's just taller than me.
Good, I can handle him.
I always expect people's voices. For some reason,
is he taller than me?
I don't know. How tall are you? You're about the same height as... You're taller than me.
See, I'd have had you as a six-footer.
See, that's because I have
heels. Oh, you've got heels on,
haven't
you? They are big shoes, actually. Mm. That's cheating.
I'm tall as it is. I'm naturally tall. I'm enhancing my legs.
You're over-talling.
That's
overclocking. Got to do what she's got to do.
Yeah. Yeah, you're like a car that's been fiddled with.
So I'm Nick Site. As I said, I'm Nick. As I said, you can find me on Twitter at Nick Site. The female voice you can hear, the very young sounding voice, that's Jessie. And she's on Instagram.
That's the third one.
How many more are you going to let him get away with?
I think that's it.
Isn't it three strikes and you're out?
Yeah, I think so. We're having too much fun. This isn't good. We're never going to get out of here.
Just to clarify, I'm not having any fun at all.
So, Jessie, where can people find you if they want to?
You can find me on Instagram at Deadpool's Girl, and you can find me on Tumblr, very annoyingly, at I'm Deadpool's Girl, because Tumblr.
Some other asshole had Deadpool's Girl.
And who's? Fuck
and
us.
Who wants to be Deadpool's Girl at 2? Or 75?
I am not
or 752?
Or like 69, huh?
I like the sexual position.
I just always assumed those people had gone through the process 68 times beforehand and someone had it already.
Am I blowing your minds tonight?
This is crazy. See, I really don't understand the internet. It's confusing. James, where can people find you?
In the Shirley area of Southampton, usually nervously twitching behind my curtains when I see people wearing fluorescent jackets in case it's the police.
Or at your therapist.
James, M-O-N-B. Still not got the appointment through, Nick.
Oh, okay. I want to know about the talking cure. I want you to report back.
Not on this show, though.
No. Oh, James and I do another show. It's called Two Grown Men. It's out on Mondays. It wasn't, well, normally 2 a.m. on Tuesdays, actually. It wasn't new and noteworthy. So if you're a new listener, you might not have heard about it. It's basically, I talk about masturbating and confusion about gender, politics, and James talks about
being depressed
and the effect it has on his penis.
So I think it's very interesting personally.
It's fascinating.
Very good.
All topics
podcast
we've covered on this show so far, though, which is so I'm trying to work out what the difference is.
If you take those bits that seem out of place on this show and stretch them out to a whole hour from beginning to end with some stuff about 90s music
that's
thrown
glorious.
In.
That's
Two Grown Men.
I miss the 90s, Nick.
Should we talk about comics? Is that what people want, do you think?
I think at this point we should, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I've got some new comics this week. I'm going to talk about them. First one I'm going to talk about I don't think is actually new this week, but our local Forbidden Planet, among the many other things they do, has started selling comics that didn't do so well on the shelf cheap. And so there are comics that I missed while they were on the shelf that are now cheap. And so I got the first issue of Stumptown, The Case of the King of Clubs, the new book of this, written by Greg Rucker with art by series newcomer Justin Greenwood. Greg Rucker's done, I think, one, maybe two Stumptown series. It's about a female private detective who works and lives in, I think, Portland, Oregon.
Which is where the dream of the 90s is still alive.
Yeah, where the hipsters are. Yeah. And Greg Rucker writes thrillers about characters like this as well. He writes prose thrillers, and he's very good at writing female characters who have a bit of meat and damage to them, What?
Wait, what do they have?
Meat and damage. I mean, the characters have meat.
I'm glad you address it.
I'm trying to avoid saying strong female characters because that's just such a catch-all and it's so boring.
Yeah.
But it's true. He's good at writing female characters. And in this one, I can't remember her name's really odd, so I always forget what it is. It starts on a football match, and it ends just after a football match.
American or European?
Soccer. Call it soccer.
European.
I think Greg Rucker's quite a fan. The main character's called Dex. She balances the being a private detective with looking after her. I think it's her younger brother who's mentally handicapped, I think, or certainly very high on the autism spectrum. So she takes him to that. They go to watch her playing football on this like kickabout with some friends, and then later on they go to an actual full-on match. I think it's a game between Portland's team and Seattle's team, and there seems to be like a lot of rivalry between the two of them. And
well, the cities are quite close, aren't they?
Yeah, so they would be like Southampton and Portsmouth.
Very similar.
Almost exactly the same. One of them's called Portland and the other one's called Portsmouth.
So now we know who to cheer for.
Yeah, they're practically... Well, she's in Portland, so... Most of this episode takes place around soccer pitches and it's an area that I'm not really that familiar with or fond of, but the emotion and the enthusiasm for the sport and the way that the rivalry between the teams is represented and stuff like that, it's really well written. She's a private detective, so you know that, and it's called The Case of the King of Clubs, so you know that the series is going to be about her investigating something. Most of this issue is set up to let you know the culture in which I think this case is going to happen, because the case is related to one of her friends who you meet through this day of soccer football related excitement. Justin Greenwood, who I'd recently seen on The Fuse, the Anthony Johnston comic, is really good on this as well. He's good at capturing the characters, but he's got a sort of an exaggerated style that does a really good job with the motion and of the football games and stuff like that. It's quite interesting because the first few pages of this are actually a football game between amateurs, and so there's lots of stuff on the pitch. The second chunk of it is all spectators at a proper stadium and behind-the-scenes stuff when they're going to get signatures and stuff like that. It's odd. I wouldn't read this comic if you told me it was a soccer-related crime-like investigation, but because it's Greg Rucker, I thought it was good.
From our childhood, there are two benchmarks for soccer-related comic stories.
Mm-hmm.
First one's Roy the Rovers. The second is Billy the Fish. How do they hold up against Roy and Billy?
Hard to say, because I can't really remember. Billy the Fish was a fish, wasn't he?
He was. He was a goalkeeper for Melchester Rovers, I think.
I think it's probably more like that.
Yeah,
it's not more like that. I don't know. It's very different from both of those.
Okay.
The thing that really stands out, the characterization and the relationships between the characters is great. The way she is with the way the main character is with her brother is so sweetly realized, though. It's really nice. I remember that from previous stories, but he's always been a peripheral character to previous stories. He's just part of her life. But this case looks like it's gonna be something that came to her through her life, so it's really good. I'm not sure what issue they're on to, though, because obviously I picked that up as an old comic and I'm not sure, but I think it's still ongoing and it's really good. So if you can find the first issue, it's great. I just want to quickly talk about Tooth and Claw number 2. I talked about the first issue on a previous show. It's an Image comic. It is $2.99, but it's really good value for money. It's a pretty thick, dense read. It's, as I said, Tooth and Claw number 2, written by Kurt Busiek, with art by Benjamin Dewey and colours by Jordi Belair. And the first issue established this world where everyone's... And they're mostly humanoid, but they're based on animals. You're not sure if it's supposed to be the distant past or the distant future or not our world at all or anything like that. But it's a really rich culture where different races are also different species, basically. There are sort of bird people. The main character in the first issue is a young lad who's the son of a trader, and he's following his dad around because someday he's going to take over. And he looks like one of those dogs, the terriers, the ones with the really smooth, snouty faces. Their faces are like all snout. What sort of dogs are those?
Like a fox terrier.
Is that what I don't know. Anyway.
Or a Scottish, Scotty dog. Scots.
No, they're like smooth white faces. They're like, they don't look like
Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, they're like Ku Klux Klan dogs. They do look a bit like they've got a hood on, actually. And Benjamin Dewey does an amazing job of realizing these characters and actually giving them expressions and understandable expressions and stuff. But the first issue, there was this situation in it where there are a bunch of wizards from all of these different cities. There are these floating cities, and there's this underclass of like buffalo people that live on the planet below that they basically treat like a slave class or a servant. Well, a working class, I guess. The wizards from all of these different cities, there's a climate change subtext. Basically, they have realized that in this world, magic is running out, and there's going to be a point where the magic runs out completely. And they're very aware that there was a time at the beginning of where records start, like a mythical time, when there was this hero, sort of Conan-esque type hero that they all tell stories about, and that magic was rife then and came into the world when that guy was around, but then disappeared. And so they decide they're going to try and bring him back. The weird thing, the weird and quite cool thing about the magic in this is it's all transactional. They talk about it like it's engineering or something. Mm-hmm. So they have to get a whole bunch to try and go back far enough in time to grab this character, this hero. They have to get a whole bunch of them together, and they're all talking about it like it's an engineering project or something. It's really, and the way Kurt Busiek writes it, it's really, really interesting. It's the sort of book, it's the sort of story that I wouldn't normally be into because there's lots of world building going on, but it's also that done right, because you find out about everything through the course of the story. There's no moment where you don't have to read the appendices or anything, which is a kind of recurring theme in the sorts of world-building stuff I don't like. All of the different species, races, species, I'm not sure if they breed across the species at this point. It hasn't been made clear.
Which says something you'd like to see.
Yeah, I think so. They all tell stories of this champion, and as far as they're all concerned, he's one of them. So we ended the last issue with this kind of mystery hanging over what exactly he was, because of course it's like in Star Trek The Undiscovered Country, where all of the different species from all over the galaxy claim William Shakespeare, I think.
Well, no, it's the scene when the Klingons come to have dinner and she says, one of the characters says, you haven't read Shakespeare till you read him in the original Klingon, yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple of bits like that are quite funny. And I love this comic. It's really good, and it's definitely worth $2.99. One thing that Kurt Busiek said online, I think, prior to this coming out, was that he had got the impression from some people talking online that because this is a talking animals book, that it was somehow all ages friendly. And he warned people that, no, in case it wasn't clear in the first one, because the first one's quite edgy, in case it wasn't clear in it, that it isn't all ages. So be careful who you give the second issue to. The second issue is brutal. There's also lots of genitalia in it. One particular genitalia. Ooh. There's a Viggo Mortensen thing going on. That reference might be lost on...
I've never seen Viggo Mortensen's genitalia.
There's a film, Eastern Promises, I think it is.
Aragorn.
No, not... Yes, him, but not as Aragorn. He's not playing Aragorn.
Aragorn.
Yeah, yay. Exactly. Well done, James. It's good to have you back.
Thank you. It's good to be back. Hi, everyone.
I think it's Eastern Promises where he has a fight in a bathhouse and he's completely knackers out for everyone to see.
Is that on video on demand anyway? Does anyone know?
Yeah, I was going to say, I know what I'm doing tonight.
I don't think you have to go to Skinemax or anything. I think it's just a film that came out. David Cronenberg makes films with Robert, what's his name? He was in Twilight. He's legit.
Oh. I'm not so keen on Robert Peston.
I don't think there's any films with him with knackers out fighting going on. Unless, I mean, I only saw the first Twilight, so I don't know where that goes afterward.
To be fair, my go-to is still Women in Love.
Yeah?
Yeah, the scene with Ollie Reed and Alan Bates fighting in front of the, wrestling naked in front of the fire.
I have never seen that, but I do like watching Oliver Reed doing interviews because he's always drunk.
I tell you, the reason I hang around, I like hanging around with John is because I think we've got that dynamic going on. Obviously, I've got the Ollie Reed thing going on. He's got the slightly smaller. I reckon if I can get him drunk enough and get him naked, we could easily reenact that scene.
I want to be there.
So anyway, the next book I got this week was Angela, Asgard's Assassin. It's from Marvel. It's $3.99. I got the Scotty Young cover.
I was going to say.
And she sat on the Rainbow Road level
it's
from
so
Mario Kart.
Cute. Yay.
Yeah, it's a little known thing. It's a little known fact about Marvel that the Rainbow Road, Asgard Road thing, was based on, well, actually stolen from Nintendo, wasn't it?
Yeah, Mario Kart.
Mario Kart.
I once played that on the N64 after eating a couple of hash brownies and almost had an accident in my pants laughing.
There's not hash browns.
Brownies.
The potato, the little potato.
No,
things.
It's when I was younger, it was the cannabis.
Oh.
I can't believe you didn't get that.
Oh. See, I've been like just cramming those things from McDonald's, wondering why I wasn't getting high.
Like burning them and trying to crumble them into cigarette papers. And it's just making the papers wet. I don't know what's going on here.
The other covers are available and they're all lovely, actually. You will not be disappointed if you like nice comic covers. This is a comic about Angela, who was formerly a Neil Gaiman / Spawn universe character. There have been lots of fights between Todd McFarlane and Neil Gaiman over the years that have ultimately culminated in Neil Gaiman, I assume, selling her to Marvel for lots of money. I don't know. And it's I've always in the back of my mind been sort of unclear on why Marvel would even bother with it, because literally the only amazing thing about that character originally is that Todd McFarlane and Neil Gaiman have been fighting over her, but she's been really good in the Marvel Universe so far. I think she just looks like the Spawn character. I don't think she's...
I think Marvel just went, we're going to do it
we
because
wanna.
We can.
Yeah. Or maybe it was a package deal with Miracle Man. I mean, it was definitely a package deal with Miracle Man, but I'm not sure what the deal was. But she's been great in the Marvel Universe. The first time I saw her, I was like, well, this is weird. And it was part of a whole dimensional multiverse, weird multiverse thing.
Age
that she
of
popped
Ultron,
into. Yeah. She popped into existence.
How did that end up? Was that good? Everyone happy at the end of that?
It was all right.
I was really confused. Yeah. I missed an issue and I was like, what the fuck has happened now? Like, it was very good, though.
I think it was compromised by taking a really long time to come out. So anything? Marvel wanted to get to a certain point at the end of it, and then they were kind of stuck. All of the stuff that's come out of it, though, like Galactus in the Ultimate Universe was quite fun and. Anyway, it's easy to do this when it comes to Angela. The point I was trying to make, though, was despite all of the weird dimension-spanning fuckery, it now seems that there's no weirdness about the fact that she was from an Image comic and now she's in Marvel. They've created this backstory that ties her very much to the Asgardian stuff, the Norse mythology side of Marvel. She's Thor's sister.
Yeah.
I think which all became apparent after Original Sin, I think. But she was brought up to hate Asgard. This is all stuff that I didn't read that bit of Original Sin. This is all stuff that I picked up from the beginning of this comic. This story it kind of tells you all of this stuff at the beginning, but then you're not entirely sure what's going on with her. She's clearly on some sort of mission. There's a suggestion in the narration that she's walking across this sort of metaphysical plane that might be part of the Asgardian, the Marvel Asgardian mythos or not. It turns out it is. She's trying to find someone, but you get the sense that, that at the same time people are chasing her. And it's this weird mix of Norse mythology, and it feels almost like a Western as well at the same time. She finds this little small outpost town, which is populated by little goblin-y, sort of Asgardian goblin-y people. But she finds the person she's after, and the person she's after is this young woman. Is clearly someone that she's got some blood oath to, that she rescued when she was a baby, and she's looked off. She's like kept an eye out for her entire life and stuff like that. But mainly she's just there to explain to other characters who Angela is so that the reader knows what's going on. There's lots of nice nice poetic prose from Kieran Gillen. It's really nice to see him writing in this sort of Asgardian mythological Marvel style, because I really liked him when he was writing Loki. It's difficult to know where this book's going to go, but I enjoyed reading it. And the art by Phil Jimenez and Tom Palmer is absolutely gorgeous. It makes a lot of use of the page. There's lots of, because she's kind of walking through this wasteland for a lot of it, the art isolates her and sets her against this vast, nothingy background. You kind of get this real sense of her from the writing and from the art that she's very much set apart. She doesn't want to be with the angels anymore. It's not spelt the way that she was from heaven, which is apparently the 10th realm, but it's spelt H-E-V-E-N. Because I guess Marvel don't want it to be all about Christianity or whatever.
And there's a load of copyright as
yeah,
well
loads.
There.
There was this ancient war between Asgard and heaven. And so, as I think I said, she was brought up to hate Asgardians. But it turns out she is an Asgardian. She's pissed off with heaven. She's pissed off with Asgard. Asgard has apparently tried to take her in. It didn't go so well, we find out in this story. So she's kind of set apart from everything, and I think we're going to find out loads more about her in the coming issues. It's a bit misleading because the name of it is Angela Asgard's Assassin. We don't really see any affiliation with Asgard.
Just because it's alliteration. That's the only reason
I think
did it.
So. And maybe that role will come out, but it might be actually spoiling where this first arc goes. I don't know. She doesn't strictly assassinate, because I tend to think of assassination as you've got a target and you go and kill them.
You get paid for it. Maybe.
Yeah, she just... There is carnage. She does kill a lot of people or fight a lot of people in this issue, but it's kind of just random violence. Well, not random.
The title reminds me of the Loki thing going on, right?
Agent of Asgard.
He's not, though. He's just off doing random shit, but...
it fits. It does sound nice. I like the title. There's loads of stuff about the way she thinks and the way heaven works, that it's entirely transactional. There's this idea that you do nothing for nothing, and it actually ends up being this theme that runs through everything. So the character I was talking about before that she saved when she was a baby, Sarah, I think her name is, she finds her when she's a baby. Her instinct is to save her, but Angela has to come up with some way that she is creating a debt that will eventually be paid off to allow her to do this thing to save this child. And it's interesting seeing how she thinks her way through those situations. It's interesting because it's quite alien. The art, as I said, by Phil Jimenez is gorgeous. There is a story within a story co-written with Marguerite Bennett with gorgeous art by Stephanie Hans, who used to paint the covers for Loki as well. It's a really nice first issue of a book. I'll be really interested to see where it goes, but it's suitably epic, considering it's a scene-setting issue. And finally, I'll try and talk about this quite quickly because I've gone on a little bit.
But he doesn't.
I say that a lot, don't I? The first issue of Crossed 100, written by Alan Moore with art by Gabriel Andrade, I think is how that's pronounced. It's an Avatar book, $3.99. It's the first issue, and it is set in the Crossed milieu, which was created by Garth Ennis as this intense and horrible I guess, zombie analog, but it's way worse than zombies. It's a little bit more like 28 Days Later, if 28 Days Later was a lot more about transgression and rape and monstrosity. It's basically, there's a point in time when people just start going nuts, and you think it's an infection, but it's unclear how it gets transmitted, probably through blood or liquids. But the way you can tell that someone is infected is they get this weird rash that is in the shape of a cross on their face, which is why it's called crossed. And basically, being infected cuts straight through everybody's inhibitions. And because it's Garth Ennis writing, what that means is people basically just become monsters. All of the stuff that is society that stops people from doing horrific things to each other just disappears. There have been lots of crossed comics by various different teams. Being from Avatar allows them to do some pretty fucking horrific things in these, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend the first few books to anyone because it's pretty heavy going stuff. As I said, there's lots of transgression in there. Sometimes you get the impression the artists and writers are just trying to see how much they can get away with, and the fact that Garth Ennis started it, we've seen him do that before, I think. But my way into this story, my way into this world, was Cy Spurrier's webcomic, which he did through the Avatar website, which was called Wish You Were Here, that was set in England. Well, set in Britain, sorry.
Scotland, wasn't it?
Yeah, it starts in London, and or at least the main character, the narrator in it.
But they end up in the Hebrides.
But they end up in the Hebrides on a little island. And so most of that story is about people being stuck on this really – a small group of people being stuck on this very safe but very remote little island, knowing that the rest of the world is just fucked, basically. And it sort of shifts between complete horror and boredom and just seeing how the characters interact with each other, like most really good zombie stories, actually, or most really good infection stories. It takes this small group of people and puts them – through this emotional shredder to try and work out how they react to it. This book is different from that because it's Alan Moore writing, and it's set 100 years after the events of all of the other crossed comics. So it's in this world where the nature of being crossed isn't that compatible with breeding. You get this sense that there's been a little bit of natural selection. Some of them have a tendency, you know, some of them are capable of it. They maybe are less likely to kill their offspring as soon as it's born, kill and eat their offspring as soon as it's born or something. But really the human population, the uninfected, has kind of risen a little bit, and you get a sense in this of a community that's happening. And so it seems like a much safer environment they're in than in the other stories, the other crossed stories. But it's written in this idiom, which is very similar to ours, but supposed to be 100 years in the future. So it takes a little bit of time to really tune into what the characters mean when they're talking. It isn't as difficult as you'd think, though. Alan Moore's done a really good job with the language, I think. And although at times it could have been self-indulgent, it actually comes across as quite, you tune into it very quickly the way you do with Shakespeare if you're reading a lot of it, or other sort of older idioms. It's it's only 100 years in the future, so he hasn't gone crazy. You know what I mean? It's just the way people swear is slightly different and stuff like that. And the art is really great by Gabriel Andrade. It's really vivid and nasty at times, but the rest of the time the characterization's really good. It follows a mission of these people who've clearly come out from one of these safe havens, and they're on a mission to go, and they call it an archiving mission. Their job is to basically go out and see if they can find books and videos and stuff like that from places where they might have survived, like libraries, and bring it back so they can try and learn about the past, try and learn about what society was like and how to do things, how to create generators and build things and stuff like that. So they're on a really interesting mission, which is something I don't think I've really seen in a post-apocalyptic sort of story before, you get a sense that there is a little bit of, there are people in their society who think these missions are a bit of a waste of time. I'm not sure what this book's going to do, but what it's reminded me is that I like Alan Moore a lot more when he's got some limitations. In this case, he's writing in somebody else's world and he is making it his own, but he's not going the full Alan Moore. He's just applying his really keen, intelligent and sometimes funny, sometimes horrific insights to this other person's world. It works really well. It's a really good comic. It's $3.99, and again, it's definitely not all ages. There are some moments of horror. There were cocks in two of the comics I read today.
Penises or male chickens?
Penises. I haven't examined every panel yet, but there might be male chickens.
Ooh.
I'm not sure.
Exciting.
Mickens.
Yeah, anyway, so those are the comics I read this week. Jesse, you have been binge reading some recent books.
I've been crying and drinking and binge reading She-Hulk. Okay. And it's been a really emotional week for me and She-Hulk. Because it's cancelled.
And it's definitely cancelled.
And like Storm, I'm not quite sure where Storm stands, but which is another comic I'm really sad about. Mm. But She-Hulk is definitely cancelled, and the last issue is going to, I think it's 12 issues overall. And for those of you who don't know anything about She-Hulk, you should pick it up.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a trade as well, isn't it?
Yes, there is a trade out. Mm-hmm. The first trade is out. It's written by Charles Soule. I have no idea how you pronounce anything.
I heard someone say it on a podcast. I think I'd go with Saul just because I'm not sure.
Well, Charles Soule and Javier Pulido is the artist who got a lot of shit for this comic, which I'm going to defend because everyone is wrong.
Yeah, well, not everyone. I mean,
no, they're all wrong.
No. A lot of people liked it. I liked it.
So this is a really interesting comic because it focuses on She-Hulk and her lawyer side. It's sort of her everyday, normal, what would happen if you had a superhero who was actually just had a day job, which is pretty much
a proper practicing lawyer.
Proper practicing lawyer, and that is pretty much what she does. The first issue starts off with her going for her first year review with a company that she's worked for, and she's really positive about it, and she's fucking badass, and she looks cool. And she essentially gets told that she's only been hired because of the fact that she's a superhero and they wanted big shot clients.
Yeah.
They wanted superhero clients from her, and they wanted Tony Stark because of all her relationships and all her teams that she's been a part of. They thought that it would come with her working there, and that hasn't happened. And they told her that she is below average and she's only here to sort of be a filler.
Yeah.
Which you would guess that you wouldn't say this to someone who is like fucking green and could kill you.
That's the important distinction between her and Matt Murdock, isn't it? That she's always been out.
Yeah, she's always
been open about.
Exactly. The thing about She-Hulk is she's always green. She can't hide herself. She doesn't have sort of an alternate personality, well, sort of character or person that she is always sort of She-Hulk, and it's really obviously you can tell. Mm-hmm. which is why it's really sad when she's then she quits and mm-hmm. she's like, fuck you guys, I don't need this from you. She definitely becomes a strong independent woman.
Yeah,
a green
strong, independent woman. She that scene is where they are saying that to her is just brutal.
Yeah,
isn't it? Because you can see her being deflated.
She's so positive when she comes in and ends up cracking the table in two and just storming out. She's like, fuck it. That's pretty much what she does. The whole thing focuses on her problems that come with her being a superhero and also the really weird cases that she gets. Mm-hmm. She then goes on to sort of start her own sort of company and a practice, and she does it on her own. But there are problems with that too, because if you're a superhero, it's very hard to find an office, rent an office or anything, because of insurance, for example.
Yeah, your liability insurance is going to be sky high.
Exactly, that's it. And it's really interesting because it really grounds the Marvel universe. Mm-hmm. I think you can really, you know, if you keep reading all the Marvel comics, you're like, oh, okay, the superheroes. And there are obvious real problems that, for example, the X-Men deal with, the fact that they are different. But this is a lot more realistic.
Yeah.
especially with the insurance. There are very weird characters in this. There's the Angie and the monkey, who ends up working with her, and a really obscure character, which I didn't know anything about, which was Patsy Walker, Hellcat.
Patsy Walker, Hellcat. Yeah, she's got a weird fan following. Not weird, it's... Yeah, she's
it's
not
obscure,
in a lot, but
I
she's well
say.
Known yeah, among certain people. It's really odd. She is odd.
Yeah, but I really like her in this, and I really like her relationship with She-Hulk that mm-hmm. she sort of has. And to be fair, I read a lot of why I read She-Hulk is for the interactions that she has with a lot of the characters. Mm. For example, you mentioned Daredevil. She has a lot. She has this really interesting lawyer rivalry between with him. And every time he appears, you're like, oh, God, we can start, like, bitching at each other again. And it's really great. And her relationship with Stony Stark.
Yeah, that's okay. That's a character from Game of Thrones, but it's fine.
Tony Stark is sort of mentioned in the very first issue where they're sort of bickering and there's a lawyer, there's a case against him. And, like, he sends all of his lawyers and it's just her and these fucking, like... I don't know, thousands of lawyers that she has to go up against. And it's really, really great. Later on, she decides to take a case for Captain America, who is not Captain America anymore. He's just Steve Rogers.
He's an old dude.
Yeah, he's
old
an
man
old
Rogers.
Dude.
Yeah,
and it's quite touching because, you know, she is a nice lawyer. And it's nice to see that. Like, he comes in and he's like, I can offer you, like, thousands for this if you do this for me. And she's like, no, Steve, this is for free. Mm-hmm. And it's really nice to see that. Like, the moment where she opens the door to the office, I think it's Patsy and Angie. They both just sort of turn around. They're like, is that like, Captain? Like, what? This, mm-hmm. like, freeze. It's really great. It's so refreshing to see this because I am a little bit sick of superheroes in my comics just like doing the same old thing, and she's really not.
Yeah,
and she does mention, like, you know, I've saved the city so many times, and I still do the hours that I do, but I've saved the city. She does have this really good balance, but it is really refreshing to see her like this, and that's why it makes me so sad that it's getting cancelled.
It is pretty sucky. I read the first few issues. I've kind of got to get up to date with it, but it's a very human book, isn't it? Like you said, it's very grounded because
definitely.
It's not all of her cases are in some way linked to the Marvel Universe or to something weird, but she's got a very She's not like the Hollywood lawyer that Matt Murdock is. You know, when you watch a film and they nail their case by coming out and giving a really big speech. She's a much more sort of, well.
That's the thing. She's a really hardworking lawyer. That's what I can give her. And it's great to see this. And, you know, when she does approach cases, she's like, okay, how am I going to do this? There's no, like, you know, she storms in at the last minute. She's like, yeah, she does that, but she doesn't do the whole, oh, I'm badass all the way mm-hmm. throughout. You can definitely see her struggle with cases. And there's a much bigger story arc with, which I don't know, they better fucking explain this because I have no idea. The blue case file is this case against her and all these other superheroes and villains. And it's part of, like, a bigger thing going on. And I really hope they explain it, because I really want to know what's happening. And every time someone tries to open the file and sort of, like, work out what's going on, they go into this, like, fucked up frenzy thing, which, like, no one can explain what's going on, essentially. Mm-hmm. And lastly, the art in this, which people can just fuck off if they complain about this, which I've heard some people have.
I so hope that line goes on the second trade.
Paperback, yeah.
People can fuck off if they don't like this.
They really, like, brilliant. Javier Pulido does such a good job at this because you do notice the art, but it flows so well with the whole story. You're like, okay, I see, you know exactly what's going on at all times, and it's so stylized.
It's lovely and clean, isn't it?
Exactly, it's so clean, and the colour in this is gorgeous, and the colour is done by... God, I don't know.
You wish you hadn't brought it up.
Munsa Vicente?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, there we are. Which is fucking fantastic. It's so nice. And I don't. No one's mentioned this online, but she dresses so realistically, first of all. Mm-hmm. But every time she's in her sort of lawyer outfit where she's doing, you know, she needs to look her best, she dresses so well. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to be She-Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know... like, she gets introduced at the beginning. She's, you know, they talk about her being, like, turned into a bombshell or whatever. But she looks really realistic for like, you know, a woman would, essentially. And it's so great. And it's so nice.
There's a lot of people wearing normal clothes.
Exactly.
In that book. Polito's art's kind of, it's kind of weird because it feels like it pays homage to really old, like, Steve Ditko style art, Marvel art from the 1960s, I guess. But at the same time, it kind of has a weird European look to it. Sometimes it looks like Love and Rockets or something. It's really, really nice.
I think I heard someone say, which got me really angry, it was like a discount version of the art in Hawkeye. And I was like, how dare you? I think I went on a small rant to
them. They're both so different.
Yeah,
though.
I know. I think there are some panels in which they do like a long shot of a building and them walking through a building. Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe that's what people thought it like it was trying to do. But it was done so differently in this. Like, oh, people are so wrong.
It's what's happening there, I think, is because it doesn't look like... And the thing is, most Marvel books, Marvel don't seem to have a house style anymore, which is a really, really good thing. But because they don't look like standard superhero books, it's not what people are expecting. They can only examine or interpret one comic in the style of another comic. But techniques like that, the use of space and moving through a building and stuff, people have been, like, Frank Miller was doing that in the 1980s with... doing similar things to that in the 1980s, and alternative comics have been doing that stuff for years. Acme Novelty Library does it loads. Chris Ware does it in that. So it's just, but it's because people don't know how to interpret this
stuff. See, that's the thing. Yeah. Like, you know, just because it's not your typical because it's not realistic in terms of, like, the art. That's great. It's fantastic. I don't want to see the realism. Yeah. I don't want to see the super detail on Wolverine's face.
Yeah.
Like, it's nice to see that all the time, but, you know, there are other ways of, like, displaying art and doing storytelling, and I think this is a really solid job. Mm-hmm. And you should pick up She-Hulk.
It's great.
And you
it's
should really write hate mail to Marvel.
Well, I don't, I mean...
And
right,
you can sign
love
it as Deadpool.
To them
no.
About
you can sign about, it as yeah. Deadpool's oh, girl okay. sent you or something.
Deadpool's girl, 752. There could be an army of Deadpool's girls.
Yes, let's do it.
Charles Saul, there's a really good interview of him on the on a podcast called the Nerdist Comic Writers Panel. I'll put it in the show notes, but him and... Jerry Duggan, I think, but he talks about She-Hulk quite a lot because he's actually a practicing attorney.
Yeah.
So that's why a lot of his stuff seems really grounded. But he isn't writing a bad book at the moment.
Like, I know, he's doing so well.
He wrote Death of Wolverine, and that was way better than I was expecting it to be.
Is he dead now?
Yeah, he's definitely
dead.
No,
he's still writing.
Oh.
What are you talking
about,
James?
You were clever.
That's comedy, folks. Thanks for that. Jesse. I like She-Hulk. It's good. James.
Jesse, if you know, you like Star Wars, don't you?
Yeah.
I like Star Wars. If you know, the trailer.
Yeah, but I'm talking to Jesse now.
Yeah, okay. I've got a tattoo, man.
We've got the same tattoo. We are tattoo brothers.
Tatooine.
Or sisters.
Tattoo twins. Tattoo twins.
That's very good. That's very good compliment.
I'm looking across the table and it's like you're fucking twins. I just can't tell you apart.
It's not fair.
He's got bigger boobs than me.
Hey, do you know what? That's probably not far off the... Oh, man.
I was putting myself down there, not really.
Yeah, but I've got really poor self-image, so...
Oh, stop it, you two. You're both gorgeous. You're as God intended.
Can we just pretend they're big pectoral muscles? Right. You know, in Star Wars, Aunt Beru's got that next to the blue milk. She's got the space chicory machine.
Yeah.
That she puts space chicory into. His computer sounds exactly like a space chicory machine. It's been putting me off.
It is rattling a bit. Sorry if you can hear that, listener.
And I've got a drink that looks like Maximilian from The Black Hole. I've been having quite a time while you two have been reviewing comics. I've been in sci-fi
You've
heaven.
You've clearly not been listening. You've just been what? Wandering off.
I enjoyed your bit, but his bit made me switch off a bit.
I'll always remember Aunt Beru and Uncle... What's his name?
Owen.
Owen Bester's... The big giant pork scratchings lying in a steaming pile.
That's just rude. It's too soon, man.
Do you know it was the 1990s before I identified that it was their skeletons outside the house.
Did you just think it was just a campfire?
Well, no, I don't even...
had a nice campfire and then
I don't even watch A New Hope on VHS. It was too fuzzy.
Oh, okay.
Small TVs.
Fuzzy. I watched it on VSH.
VHS.
VHS. God, I'm so fucking tired today.
I know the feeling.
Stony Tark.
Stony Tark's good. Stony Tark is going to be in the next series of Game of Thrones. I don't know why you're being so hard on yourself.
My favourite character.
I thought he sounded like a character from Absolutely.
That's going back
Stony a bit. Bridge.
In the... Never mind.
What's Absolutely?
It was from the 1980s. It's a Scottish sketch show. From the 1980s. This isn't fair because you've actually asked a question about something that was before you're born now, and I'm not allowed to say anything.
Go on, make it a fourth. Come on.
In the 1980s, there was a program called Absolutely.
And 90s. Morwenna Banks was on it, who is the voice of Queen Thistle and Mummy Pig from Peppa Pig.
I love Peppa Pig.
James is obsessed with Peppa Pig. He goes to Peppa Pig World at least once in a blue moon.
I've been this year. My daughter's getting a bit old for it now. She's too sophisticated.
That's the other podcast. James, you've got something to talk about.
I have. listener, have you been affected as I have by recent events? If so, alcohol, drugs. just forget about it.
Do you want a time limit?
Just try and... I find what works best, if you just deaden yourself off to the world... then it can't hurt you.
Would you like a time limit?
I don't care. You didn't have a time limit. He must have gone on for at least half an hour. Yeah. What do you reckon?
Don't do this, James. This is beneath you.
don't spoil this. give me 10 minutes because I'll never use all of that. If you listen, I'll tell you what, actually. I was thinking about this the other day. I was lying in bed thinking about this book and I did a little review in my head. And I nailed it. I was really, there's no way I'm going to be able to reach the heights that I reached the other evening.
How long was it in your head?
I don't know. 7-8 minutes? if you listen to the Momcast, you may be aware that I reviewed all of the Tintin books. Stupidly, I didn't do them in sequence and it all got a bit confusing for me after a while because actually what I've been doing is the Asterix books and I'll carry on doing Asterix books at some point, I think, probably. I don't know if Nick lets me.
Yes, but I want you to.
But I'm doing them...
It's the only reason I hang out with you.
Good. And I'm doing them in chronological order and actually I'm finding it's creating a narrative, which is quite useful. Anyway, for Christmas, I got a present and it was from life partner Steve and Jane. And it's The Adventures of Hergé. It's a biographic comic about the creator of Tintin, Hergé. And it follows pretty much the same format as the standard Tintin book. So 62 pages long in the Lanny Clare style, as it were. Also, it's got the lovely, if you buy the hardback Tintin books, you know that there's a portrait gallery in the inside and back cover. There's one here as well, but it's, although it's in a similar style, it's much looser. Than you would expect to see from a Hergé drawn book or a studio Hergé, as it was. It's written by José-Luis Boucher and Jean-Luc Fromentel and illustrated by Stanislas Barthélemy.
Okay.
Sorry, I slipped over Stanislas' surname. I apologise, Stanislas, unreservedly. And I'm going to mention this as well because I think it's beautifully done. It's translated by Helge Dasher and a really, really good job of translation. It flows and reads absolutely beautifully given that English isn't the language it was written in. So basically, the book itself is a biopic of Hergé's life. We meet him as a young boy in 1914 and the book itself is basically vignettes based on events that happened in certain years. So there'll always be prefaced with the year and then events unfold. So we start off by meeting a young Hergé. We get to, it's quite funny actually, the jewel song that Castafiore sings in the Tintin books. One of his aunts is singing it on a piano and he's not having a very good time. And we meet his young brother. It looks like it provided some inspiration from an early iteration of Tintin. We move through some time that he spent in the Scouts and when he first got involved in, I forget the name of the priest that got him involved in Le Petit Vingtième and Le Cirque, which were the newspapers he worked for. But we get to hear a little bit about his background and some of the mythos behind it, that possibly he had some royal blood that was covered up, and there may have been some intrigue around his birth and so forth, which is quite cute. But also you get to see him as a very straight middle class child of the early part of the last century as well. Mm-hmm. He wasn't particularly his early life, the way that this is presented, he wasn't a particularly extraordinary person. He just, it's almost fortune falls into illustrating Tintin for Le Cirque. And we see a little bit of the phenomenon those early stories caused. Obviously, Tintin and the Soviets. And there's a lovely piece here from 1930 where, as a big publicity stunt, they basically got an actor to arrive back in Brussels at the end of Tintin and the Soviets. Mm-hmm. So they had Tintin basically turn up in Brussels returning from his adventures.
So it was successful from very early on then. Very
yeah,
early
yeah,
in
yeah, absolutely,
run.
Yeah.
And hugely successful, mainstream yeah. success.
Yeah, absolutely. It was huge. I mean, it's hard to imagine now, you know, you see sort of big, you know, people turning out for big Hollywood blockbusters. But this was someone turning, you know, it's like, like Dilbert or something, you know, sort of turning up. Because this is at this point, it's a newspaper strip. Yeah. Yeah, that ran over a long time. There's a little bit, you don't really get to see how Hergé was quite a naive young man and coerced into making some quite unfortunate choices early on. I mean, obviously, his first two books are Land of the Soviets and Tintin in the Congo. Hergé later in his life said that, you know, Tintin and the Soviets, it was ignorant. He didn't know anything about the Soviet Union at that time. And basically, it was all written from a point of prejudice and propaganda. But that's kind of what he was asked to do. That was his job. And Tintin in the Congo isn't touched on at all, funnily enough. But again, that was written from a very naive standpoint of colonial superiority. We covered that at the time. I did enough of dancing around that and being uncomfortable when I reviewed it.
I didn't realise those were the first two, though, to be honest.
Yeah. We get to meet Chang, who was featured in two of the books, The Blue Lotus and Tintin in Tibet, and that was an instrumental point of his life where we actually get to see him maturing into a more free-thinking adult, which is and there's some intrigue there, which is very enjoyable. And then we go into the sort of the part of Hergé's life. We go through the war period, and he's has a slightly uncomfortable time after the war, because obviously he was writing for a paper that was controlled by the Nazis. But then we start to see him as a human being emerge as a true artist, as someone who has an appreciation of the finer things around him, and also his very difficult love life. Obviously, he was married for a very long time to his wife, as many people are. I know
many
I'm.
People are married to his wife.
Well, I know I'm married to my wife, and I know you're married to yours.
That's true.
I have no wife to marry.
Well, you could do, thanks to the progressive civil partnership laws in this country. Elizabeth, Remy, and it's one of the things I actually learnt from this was I think it was Tintin in Tibet when he was starting to, his marriage was starting to fall apart, and he'd fallen in love with Fanny, who worked in Studio Hergé with him.
In America, that means bottom.
It does.
In this country, it means vagina. Yeah.
Does it mean what? Really?
Vagina, Fanny. Mm. Yeah.
I know that part.
Yeah.
I didn't know the
in America word. It means bottom.
Yeah. So when they say fanny packs, they're talking about bum packs, not
it's
front
not
bottom
a vagina
packs.
Pack.
It's so strange.
Language is funny. Sorry, James.
What I found really charming, and something I didn't know about Hergé, though, was even after he divorced Elizabeth to go and live with Fanny, he went to visit Elizabeth in her home once a week, every week, until he died. They maintained a very close relationship, which is very funny. A lot of that skirted over, and I think one of the weaknesses of this book, if there are any, is because it's played out in these small vignettes that are told in a chronological time, all given about the same amount of breathing room the same amount of panels, there are periods of his life that are really fascinating, and I would have liked to have seen expanded. Mm-hmm. I find his awakening as an artist, meeting Chang, his awakening as an artist, fascinating period of his life. You know, he basically went from this guy who'd kind of fallen into being a cartoon artist to someone who brought a real art to what he did and elevated the art of what he did as well permanently. And also, you know, his rather complicated love life. And then later on in his life, when he was reunited with Chang, after he'd written Tintin in Tibet in a way that eerily echoes that story in many ways. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he had a very full, very busy, very interesting life. But also, it kind of reflects a man that, had he maybe been a little more focused, could have produced a lot more work potentially, and also portrays a man who wasn't fully creatively fulfilled by the monster he created. I mean, Tintin was all-consuming, and for large periods towards the end of his life, it would appear that it was a burden to him, and something that it wouldn't let him fully express himself creatively. I knew a fair bit about Hergé before I read this. Obviously, going through all the books, reviewing them for the podcast, I picked stuff up from Wikipedia. I'm a keen fan, or I very much enjoy Simon Doyle's Tintinologist website, mm-hmm. which is a fantastic resource for Tintin fans. There's a lot of very interesting writing on there and sort of biography stuff. But, you know, there were some gems in here, definitely, that I hadn't picked up before, and it does a very good job of telling quite a long, complex story, but really paying full homage to him by following the format that he set out in the Tintin books. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's really good. Funnily enough, I've brought this about four times to review. Look at that. I'm just summing up, mate. It's brilliant. I nailed that. I brought this several times to review, so I've read it twice now. And I hope to read it again, but it should still be available. It's $19.95, and published by Drawn and Quarterly.
Couldn't resist that last momentary dig at my organisation. The reason James hasn't been able to do his spotlight on that before is because I keep badly managing the shows.
That's right, and I sit here patiently waiting to review it.
You're just not a good friend. No,
he's
I'm not a good friend.
No.
I'm not a good showrunner. Nope. It's all true. I regret everything.
I'm sorry, listener.
It's good that I almost went page by page and then bailed out of it about halfway through. I think I got away with that. No one to notice.
It was lovely. I am now fascinated by these weekly visits to his ex-wife.
It's only touched on very briefly.
Well,
but
I mean,
But that's what I meant about there were certain aspects of his life that needed more analysis. I think in terms of making it a truly satisfying biopic, but in terms of like a whistle stop tour through his life, works brilliantly, really well translated, and the dialogue's very believable. And
it looks gorgeous.
Yeah, I really absorbed into the story. It was really lovely.
There will be links. There will be a link to that book on Amazon in the show notes.
Well worth buying. If you are a Tintinologist, a Tintin fan, I think your Tintin collection isn't actually complete without this book.
Blimey.
Serious.
New listeners, it's worth mentioning as a kind of disclaimer that any links to Amazon on the site for this show or in the show notes, we do get a tiny little amount of money if you buy something using those links. So that might be a reason to do that. It might be a reason to not do that, depending on how much you hate us.
And also, if you're a new listener, if you do want to go back and listen to anything that we discussed on the Momcast, it is still available on iTunes.
Absolutely. Momcast is still available. Yeah. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
251
of them. 251 episodes.
Have fun.
You can probably, we were drunk for a lot of the first few.
Not me.
No,
you were talking about this last week. I was never drunk.
No.
I missed out on all of this. This is just bullshit.
It was an incoherent mess. Don't worry about it.
It was basically for the first few episodes, four, three drunk men and me sat in my spare room as was terrified of making idiots of themselves and sort of shouting into a microphone that was sat in the middle of the room. It was... It's not good.
That sounds great.
No, this is much better, I promise you.
We're winding down, aren't we? I guess.
I am. I'm almost 40. It's all downhill, it's really. It's all gone wrong for me, Nick.
Definitely at least halfway through our lives.
Oh, at least. Oh, I reckon I hit midlife at 30.
So worth listening to, other than this show, obviously, and all of our previous shows, the, as I mentioned, the Nerdist comic writers panel with Charles Saul and Jerry Duggan is really worth a listen, especially if Jesse piqued your interest about She-Hulk. Stacey's Pop Culture Parlor. Stacey is a friend of a podcasting friend of mine. She did a recap of Thought Bubble 2014, which I really enjoyed listening to.
You're never going to let go, are you? You're just going to keep reminding
me. And I mentioned on it at least a couple of times, so I thought it was brilliant. She also says some very interesting things about leaving feedback for things that you like, which is a perfect segue into me saying that, listen, if you've enjoyed this, please do share us with your friends and, you know, enemies and that. But also, if you can rate and review us on iTunes or wherever it is you listen, or if you can talk to us, if you like something we've said or dislike something you said or want to correct us on something, you can either post a comment on the post for this episode, or you can email us at issuespod@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at issuespod. And, there's a Facebook page. There is a Tumblr, which I've started posting stuff to again, but at the moment I seem to be flooding it with links to these episodes on YouTube. They're also on YouTube and they're also on SoundCloud. So there's plenty of opportunities there to leave us comments and get in touch and stuff. I guess that's us done.
Yay.
I feel very tired. Do you feel tired?
No, I'm pumped.
You're pumped?
I want to go clubbing.
All right, okay. Well,
I'm not going to.
Well, I'm far too old for clubbing. I just want to go home.
Yeah. I want to go and have my tea and have a little sit down.
Should we say goodbye?
Bye then.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. I wasn't abused as a child.
Well.
Not on purpose.
Not physically.
I see.
Emotionally. I
fucking moved it.
We're doing Jesse's sound check now, though.
Okay.
Can't this be all about me? Sorry, Jesse, I'm just going to talk all over you. Can't this be about me for a bit longer? Oh, look at me, everyone.
John's not
love me, mummy!
You've got the other podcast for that, Jesus. Yeah.
That's true. We have got the other podcast. The only problem is I talk all over him on the other podcasts.
Was that it was a rejected title, wasn't it? Why Don't You Love Me Enough, Mummy? Podcast.